Welcome to the Robin Report podcast series, Radical Times Require Radical Actions, with host Robin Lewis. Each show, we feature stories and guests from the Robin Report online. For more information, visit therobinreport.com. Now, here is your host, Robin Lewis.
I'm Robin Lewis, and welcome to the Robin Report podcast series and our ongoing theme, Radical Times Require Radical Actions, where my guests and I provide unfettered insight into the inner working of the business of retail. I'm your host and founder and CEO of the Robin Report. And if I do say so myself, I don't think there's any other report like it. It is very provocative. It's in your face with really powerful expert opinions on every major event in the retail and brand worlds. We do connect the dots and enlighten our readers with strategic insights and perspectives that they really can't get anywhere else. So if you're not already signed up for our daily email blast, please go to my website, therobinreport.com, and sign up. It's free. Okay, I thought we should start our conversation with a big picture background for our listeners. And the big picture is the retail industry is in the middle of what I would call the perfect storm, which is like three violent weather fronts colliding at the same time. It really is disrupting everything in the old world of retailing and brands, and we are just now in the middle of literally building a whole new world. So the perfect storm, it's three violent weather fronts. The first being technology, and under that primarily the smartphone. The second would be a whole new young consumer culture with an entirely new set of values and a new definition of just what value is. And a big part of it has to do with the fact that they're armed with the smartphone, which when you think about it, unbelievably, everything in the world is packed into that little device. So at the touch of a key, these consumers can have anything their heart desires, which means that the physical store is no longer the point of sale. With the smartphone, the consumer is now the new POS. Wherever they are, whenever they want something, how and how often. So and the third part of the perfect storm is simply overcapacity. We are overstored, or any way you want to describe it, and which, by the way, has been a growing issue ever since it was identified in the early 1980s. Between then and now, on average, retail space has been growing about 4% a year. Population growth of maybe 1%. So these major dynamics and with many offshoots are forcing the fundamental transformation of the old retail and brand models and the explosion of new startup models, including Amazon, I might add. Bezos continues to say that they are in startup mode. So our theme, Radical Times Require Radical Actions, and for those who don't create radically new visions, objectives, and strategies to get it done, they're simply not going to be around. And by the way, as an aside, the Robin Report is going to be searching throughout the legacy traditional brick-and-mortar retail industry to find radical thinkers and doers within those companies who we judge to be entrepreneurs and innovators who are driving their company's successful transformations. And the Robin Report Radicals program, in collaboration with SAP, will be unveiling and celebrating those these radicals all during 2020. Okay, joining me today from the NPD Group are three of their top advisors in the retail, sports, and food service industries. We have Don Unser, Retail President, Matt Powell, Vice President, Senior Industry Advisor for Sports, and David Portalatin, Vice President, Industry Advisor for Food. So Don has been on several shows with us, and he makes this bold statement that data is imperative to success in business today. And I would add to that, I think it's almost an understatement. Whether you're a startup or a heritage brand, a retailer, online, digital native, or omnichannel, if you are making decisions without data, you are taking huge unnecessary risks. So I wanted to do a deep dive today into what opportunities NPD's data, along with their industry expertise and prescriptive analytics, what opportunities they can open for all retailers and brands. So welcome, Don, David, and Matt. And I thought we should start our conversation with some context about the health of the consumer and what's on their minds as we are heading into the all-important holiday season. And to say the least, there are a lot of distractions for the consumers today, and that's an understatement. I mean, the short list of preoccupations and some headaches, I might add, include the 2020 presidential election, the impeachment proceedings, tariffs, immigration, climate change, consumer confidence, the economy in general, all leading into this holiday season. And technology, I don't have to tell anybody, is incredible, and it has elevated consumers' expectations beyond belief. I mean, with a tap of a key, they can get anything their heart desires and in a nanosecond. So their demands are ratcheting up more and more in terms of product innovation, experiences, greater accessibility through delivery, personalization, this whole thing about, you know, it's got to be special for me. Transparency and sustainability is now sticking with particularly the younger consumer cultures. So the face of retail continues to evolve rapidly. And while brick and mortar remains important, the normalization of the number of stores out there across all industries continues. In fact, it's predicted that 12,000 stores will have closed by the end of this year. So our theme, Radical Times, require radical actions. And for those who don't build radical visions and objectives and act radically to get it done, as I've said before, they are going to fail. Okay, now with our NPD experts, let's focus our attention on today's topic, which is the health of the consumer and what that means for retail now and into 2020. So, Don, you've been a guest before, and we are happy to have you back, particularly with your teams. And so I'd like you to do is give us a little more color on NPD and what you do. And by the way, how and where does NPD collect the tons of data you have? And by the way, I might add here that NPD, by the way, is the sixth largest market research firm in the world. So especially how powerful this data is in defining the behavior of the changing consumer and the face of retail. I have to believe there are very few listeners out there who have not heard of NPD or in how important your data is for driving business growth. But give us a little bit more on that, Don, please.
You bet. Hey, Robin, thanks for having us on. I appreciate the questions and the ability for us to talk about what we're seeing out there with retail. So NPD is a market research firm that's been around for a little over 50 years. We are privately held, and we try to help clients understand the current landscape of retail and track their performance and also expose opportunity of how they can perform. And the best-in-class retailers are using data and insights and they're using it in a way that is a competitive advantage to them. And we have on with me Matt Powell, who is our foremost advisor and expert on sports, and David Portaladdin, who is tracks our food and restaurant industries. And I think we're going to get a great sense in this conversation, Robin, of how the consumer is doing going into this holiday season and what we're seeing. One thing I did want to comment on just to kick things off is the consumer is very distracted, Robin, as you said in your opening statements. However, we are still seeing the consumer spend. And many of our categories that we track, and we track a breadth of industries. We track 21 industries totaling $1 trillion worth of U.S. consumer spend. Most of that spend is discretionary spend. Now, in David's case, there's some categories because we have to eat that are not necessarily discretionary, but much of that is discretionary spend, and the consumer is spending at a rate, depending on the businesses that we name, on average around 2% growth. So there still is growth in retail. And one last piece on your opening statement as well. The consumer is buying things differently, and we're going to probably talk about that a little bit here. Most of our industries have moved somewhere between 10 to 40% of the sales for those industries are now online. Wow. Or being bought something digital. And with that happening, Robin, and you said this many, many years ago, there's going to be an adjustment to the infrastructure. A store that's in an industry can't have 30% of their sales move online and still have a viable model to have as many stores as they have today.
Well, thanks for aging me, Don.
So it wasn't that long ago that you
years and years ago. Anyway, but you're right on that. Well, I'm glad to hear the consumer is still spending. And I think a little in a few minutes, we're probably going to get to some more detail on that as we're heading into the season here. Anyway, thanks for all of that, Don. And yeah, in my introduction, I did mention some of the consumer's concerns. And so what is your diagnosis of their health status, so to speak? I mean, you've given us a little bit of that. So what does it look like going forward as well?
We think there's a healthy consumer out there, Robin. There are a lot of distractions, like you said, but the macroeconomic factors that are around a consumer of we have more people back to work or to work, that we have households making more money than we've seen in the last 10, 15 years on average. We have every economic indicator that is around the consumer is all healthy. Now, that's not to say we don't have industries that are struggling with growth. Apparel, for example, is an industry that is struggling with growth and has been for a couple of years. And you're one of the foremost experts on apparel out there. But there's also lots of pockets of growth, and we're going to talk about those here with the other folks that we have on. But the consumer is in a healthy state in my mind, Robin.
Yeah, good. And that's a very optimistic note. And coming from you guys, we can probably bet on it. But David, why don't you give us a little background and what you're seeing in your particular industry?
I would agree with what Don said. The consumer from a food and beverage perspective is healthy. The great thing about food is it doesn't really matter what the economy is doing. We're going to eat. We're measuring about 461 billion eating and drinking occasions every single year. And the vast majority of those at our home, sourced from our refrigerator, our pantry, our freezer, and about 20% of those are meals that are prepared by a food service professional, most likely at a restaurant, but that would also include, healthcare, K-12 education, university dining, those kinds of things. But over the last few months, if anything, the dollar sales on the food service side of the equation have actually accelerated. Now, the picture is a little unclear because that dollar growth is really an escalation in menu prices. And I think we all know the labor struggles that the restaurant industry is having, really, I guess, across the entire economy, with the unemployment rate being so low, and food service for a lot of people is sort of a last resort. And so labor is a struggle. Minimum wage laws are up. So there are a lot of margin pressures for restaurant operators. The average restaurant check is up 14% over the last 5 years. And so that's driving a lot of the dollar growth that we see. But throughout the summer and really into September and October, you still see strong dollar volumes in the restaurant industry. The underlying customer transactions, however, have been relatively soft, but that's less about the consumer economy and more about shifting life stage demographics in our country right now. Our aging population is simply shifting into a life stage that favors more in-home meal preparation.
Yeah, but you know, I read somewhere, Matt, where the young millennial and Gen Z generations are eating more in restaurants, fast food places, casual food places. Is that correct?
Well, you know, millennials right now are sort of at the peak of restaurant consumption from a life stage perspective. And if you think about it, it's what I call peak career and family formation life stage. We're busier than we ever have been. We're raising kids. We're trying to get promoted at work. And so we value the convenience of outsourcing food preparation to a professional. The problem is millennials entered into that life stage with two key differences compared to past generations. One is a different economic reality. And we can all, you know, look at all the data around the average net worth of a 35-year-old today versus 20 or 30 years ago, and the increase of healthcare costs and student debt and things like that that have changed over time that simply restrict the amount of their budget that would go to the higher ticket food service occasion. And also that generation ushered in a different set of food values. So this is where we get into concerns around health and wellness and sustainability and all these other things that really favor in-home food production. Now, here is the silver lining in all of this, is that emerging Generation Z, I can promise you one thing, and I have 30 years of trend data to back this up, Generation Z will eat more restaurant meals next year than they did this year, and so on and so on and so on for about another decade. So for restaurant operators who want to win over the coming years, you better understand Generation Z, because they are the ones that are coming.
Yeah, I guess that's what I read. It just got a little mixed up there. David, what about your sector on this topic?
Yeah, again, thanks for having us on, Robin. And I echo a lot of what Don opened up with. Probably the most important thing to think about in the sports world is that the consumer today is very focused on health and wellness. And David, I think, sees the same thing in his world, people trying to live healthier lifestyles. But one of the interesting things that's happened over the last decade or so is that the consumer has become less committed to one fitness activity, and less committed to the kind of level of fitness that maybe prior generations had. It's a much more lighthearted approach to fitness today, and it's very social. We have moved away from going to the gym and working out on a machine and going home and not talking to anybody. Most people who are going out to do fitness today are taking a class. And if you're taking a class, you see the same people week over week, and you develop a social bond with them, a friendship with them. And that alters, I think, the way we think about how we dress and how we approach that activity. And I think this is really what's given rise to athleisure, is this idea of being in a social environment and wanting to look nice for your friends. And athleisure is very much, it has a firm grip on what's happening today in fashion. As Don mentioned, the apparel business is not very good. The footwear business is not very good. Correct. But athletic apparel and athletic footwear continue to perform better than fashion footwear and fashion of apparel. And so I think that's an interesting dynamic. And in many cases, you know, we've really gone from having three wardrobes, a wardrobe for work and a wardrobe for workout and a wardrobe for the weekend, to having one wardrobe. And we can wear athleisure apparel, I guess the best way to say it, to many social occasions today that we could not have 10 years ago. And I think part of why we're seeing this malaise in apparel is this sort of one wardrobe idea. I don't need to have three different sets of outfits. I can get away with just doing one.
Yeah, I see that all the time. And even not just among the young people. I mean, I can't remember the last time I wore a suit and a tie.
Yep.
I mean, I asked Brooks, the CEO of Brooks Brothers, you know, how is his suit and tie business? He said, Robin, he said, it's not great.
No.
So, you know, and you're right. I think this, and I've said this before too, I think the younger generations are more into the style of life than the stuff of life, so to speak.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a mixed picture out there. I don't know if there are any clear winners or not. And, you know, Don, you mentioned this earlier that you guys, another unique perspective that retailers and brands can get from you guys is that you have a unique perspective because across all consumer-facing industries, because you track, as you said, 21 different general merchandise industries, so which allows you to have insight across all industries and therefore trends, including the categories performing well and those laggards who need to step up their game. So, Don, can you take us a little bit further into what you're seeing across retail?
And sure, yeah.
Winners and losers and stuff, yeah.
You bet, you bet. One thing I think it's important to understand is how we not only have ideas and thoughts about what's happening in retail, we have the data that backs up what we think. And that's what makes us unique in terms of being advisors to the top retailers, the top restaurant operators, the top brands, the top food ingredients in the world. So we get data from retailers at the point of sale level, from many of the retailers, most of the retailers in the industries that we cover. We also do about 14 million completed surveys a year in these industries to give us the color around why a consumer is buying what they buy. And then finally, we have a third data asset that is receipts, that is kind of a hybrid between the two. It's a passive collection methodology where we will look at receipts. We get them a whole host of different ways. We will code the receipts into the industries, and we also know something about the individual that gives us the receipts. So we're able to tie all that together. So it's important to know, Robin, kind of what we're looking at, because there are lots of people out there prognosticating, if you will, on where retailers been, where retail's been, where it's going, and what's happening with the consumers. But we have amazing levels of data that allow us to do that. And we not only have the store data, but we also have any other channel that the consumer's interacting in. If they're interacting online, if they're interacting in buying online, picking up in store, if they are having a meal delivered to them, if they're having a meal picked up in a restaurant and digitally ordering it. We look at all of those things, and that's what makes us relevant to the industries that we serve.
Well,
some other trends that we're seeing out there. We're seeing industries or categories, I should say, that are growing because they help consumers make their lives easier. And a perfect example of that is the last 2 years we have seen a product called the Instant Pot, really take off.
What?
And the Robin, this is a 50-year-old plus technology of a pressure cooker with a computer on the front of it. And it came to market about 2.5-3 years ago. It wasn't under one of the big brands, and it is now has a household penetration above 20% in the U.S. And this product will do what a slow cooker does, for example, in 1/10 of the time. So it saves whoever's in charge of doing the meals at home. It saves them time. And we see that over and over again of all kinds of things that are categories that are resonating with consumers. If you save a consumer time or you take any stress out of their life,
you will certainly be rewarded with incremental sales. So that's just one trend we're seeing. We have all kinds of trends that we see, and Matt and David can go on and on about all of these types of consumer-born trends that are out there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it goes all the way back to what we were talking about earlier, about David was actually talking about young, the Gen Zs are going to, it's about convenience. It's about, yeah, time is their luxury in many ways. So, yeah, Matt, could you kind of expand on that in your particular area?
Sure. I think we're consumers here in the sports world are very focused on versatile products, products that can do more than one thing. They are not looking for the pinnacle product that's a single use or rarely used kind of product. Those are they're moving very quickly away from. But products that can be, say, a jacket that can be worn in various kinds of weather because it's a 3-in-1 jacket that allows you to take parts in and out. A boot that looks fashionable but is waterproof and can be worn to work in a casual environment or can be worn on a light hike. This idea of versatility is really, really important right now.
Yeah, David, you talked about health and wellness and sustainability, home, in-home food prep and so forth. What are some of the other trends in?
Well, I was glad to hear Don mention the Instapot. I mean, it was the perfect product at the perfect time, and it's really a nexus of things that are happening all at the same time that enable something like that to take off the way that it did. I mentioned millennials in career and family formation life stage.
Yeah.
And they had a different set of food values. So the food values are, you know, I want to eat real food, authentic food, minimally processed food. I want to shop the perimeter of the grocery store. I want to actually cut back a little bit on what I'm spending at restaurants. But add on to that, none of them are prepared to be Michelin star level chefs in the home. A lot of them do not know how to cook. They weren't raised to cook. Enter in something like the Instapot that enables me to put a center of the plate protein, some vegetables. I can go to the center of the store and I can spice that up with some, you know, bold ethnic inspired flavorings, sauces and seasonings and so forth. And then I can leave the house and control that from my smartphone while I'm at work during the day and have this authentically prepared meal that I feel good about that meets all my goals for health and wellness and all these other things. But I didn't personally have to get involved and dirty up a lot of pots and pans in the kitchen to cook. So it's absolutely the convenience thing that Don mentioned. It fits a long-term trend that we've seen in the home of meal simplification, where, you know, 30 years ago, dinner was a center of the plate protein, a couple of sides, an appetizer, maybe a roll, and a dessert. And now it's whatever dish comes out of that Instapot and maybe a bottle of water. So things have become simpler. It's all about speed. It's all about convenience. And it enables that convenience in a way that also supports people's ability to make choices that they feel good about.
Where do you buy one of these?
Oh, just about everywhere. Don, you feel free to chime in there, but, pretty much all of mass retail, they're even on the grocery store aisle. Anywhere that sells kitchen electrics, you can find these multi-cookers, to use the generic term. Instapot is a brand. And there are other things. You know, we're seeing the air fryer start to emerge. We're even seeing sous vide machines, which you think of sous vide as this really high art culinary form of French cooking, but what it's really doing is enabling the same thing. They can be Wi-Fi controlled by your smartphone, and what it does is it enables you to cook a piece of typically an animal protein, a steak, a piece of fish or something, and cook it to perfection without having great culinary skill, and all controlled remotely if necessary. So, you know, all kinds of those devices are enabling convenience in the home. That's why, you know, we forecast over the next 5 years, in-home prepared meals actually will outpace restaurant prepared meals.
So what about the Gen Zs, though? You said a little earlier
that the Gen Zs are going to be the ones that are going out to restaurants more, and that's purely a function of life stage.
Okay.
This has always been true of people at that age of life. It always will be true. And we can expect Gen Zs to commit more and more of their spending, more and more of their share of stomach, which is an industry term that we use in food, to the food service side of the business. But it's all about convenience for them, too. And that's where we get into the frictionless food experience. They're going to access that food on their smartphone, whether they're picking it up or whether they're having it delivered by a DoorDash, Uber Eats, or Grubhub. It's still going to be convenience, you know, faster, easier, at the center of the equation there.
Yeah, well, you know, the more you guys talk, the more it is very clear that data is imperative to break down the complexity of all these emerging trends. I mean, you simply have to have it. So, you know, we're talking here about some of the emerging trends. One of the things that you mentioned on Grubhub, David, and I also read where these food delivery, restaurant delivery businesses are not making any money.
Right. Well, this is where, you know, this presents the possibility of a real transformation of the brick and mortar restaurant landscape. Now, you guys in retail are way down the road on this with reduced store counts and, you know, network optimization, and the restaurant industry is late to the party on that. But here's what's going to happen, because Robin, as you said, delivery is being subsidized right now in part by gross margin from the restaurant operator, in part by investment investors in these companies that are, you know, supporting these third-party delivery models, and then in part by the consumer who's paying a premium for the delivery. And in my mind, that's not really sustainable. Now, it's growing. It's growing by double-digit rates when nothing else in the restaurant space is, and so that's why there's a lot of attention for it. But yeah, it's also why you're seeing a lot of investment into redesigning the brick-and-mortar model. And so you see companies like Kitchen United, which is a shared kitchen space that even big established brands can come into and co-locate with other brands. So you have a sort of a common back of the house, a sort of a common front of the house that is really not for consumers. It's for expediting orders to delivery drivers. And then everybody sort of carves out their own proprietary space in the middle. And if something like that can really lower the cost basis and present a new economic model that unlocks delivery as a profitable venture, then that's where I think you'll really see delivery take off.
Do you think a part of that might be driverless robots?
Yeah, they're talking about that now. I even see where you know, people have talked about drone delivery. You know, drone delivery doesn't work in your, you know, fifth floor apartment window. But they're even experimenting with concepts where the drone can drop something onto the roof of a nearby, say, Uber driver to finish the last leg of the delivery. You're seeing autonomous vehicles being tested I believe it's in Scottsdale right now, for food delivery. You know, all these things are pretty futuristic. It remains to be seen whether any of them actually becomes mainstream viable. But what's clear in all of this is that the American consumer places a tremendous value on that last mile delivery. And I think my colleagues on the phone would echo that, because I think we see that in all of the industries that we track, whether it's food or whether it's sneakers. People are saying, bring it right to my front door.
I know, it's crazy. It is crazy. You know, now in the grocery area, they're talking about, is it Walmart that will take it and put it right into your refrigerator?
The smart key approach, where you authorize on a limited basis security credentials to allow people to actually come in and unpack the groceries.
That's incredible. Well, let's move from food to Matt. What's going on in all of these areas? You know, as David said, the food business, restaurant business, behind the apparel business. So, you know, BOPUS, buy online, pick up in store, and so forth. Give us a little expanded commentary on your space.
Sure. Well, I think it's echoing some of what David said. One of the interesting things we're seeing in the sneaker business right now is a push on the consumer for uniqueness. And they want products that are similar to what their friends are wearing, but have a different label. And so we're seeing the small brands like Fila and Champion and Puma and Vans, growing much faster than the marketplace. And this push for uniqueness is also a push for speed. The consumer wants products faster than they've ever had them before. We're not relying on one style to take us for months and months and months of growth. It really is forcing the brands and the retailers to create unique spaces or constantly changing spaces. And then, again, back to your question, the consumer's using their cell phone to learn where these products are, to learn which retailers have them, what the prices, best prices are, and then they are visiting those physical stores. So we talk a lot about blended retail now, as opposed to omnipresent retail, where we're really thinking along the lines of the entire transaction between physical and digital is all wound up in itself, and there isn't one path; it's many paths.
Correct.
And we have to be prepared with things like BOPUS, and now there's a reserve online pickup in store where your credit card's not getting hit until you say hit it, but the product is set aside for you as you arrive at the store. We're seeing, obviously, retailers who are taking back returns for other retailers.
Yeah, I know.
As a way of bringing in traffic and so forth. So the paradigm, the platforms that we have grown up with, we've learned to understand, are really breaking down now. And I think brands and retailers have to be very open to all possibilities of doing business with the consumer.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I mean, the word omnichannel is a miss. It isn't the appropriate definition of what's really going on today, which you just mentioned. Everybody is operating on everybody else's platform. I mean,
yes.
You got Amazon and Kohl's, you've got Nordstrom. You can pick up, wait a second, you pick up Macy's stuff at Nordstrom, or maybe I got that wrong. But anyway, you get the point, and you guys are way into it.
Robin, the interesting point on that is that the biggest winner in all of this is the consumer.
Yes.
The consumer has access to an amount of products they've never had access to. They have access to product being delivered to them at a fraction of the cost back in the mail order days, for example. The consumer has totally won in this entire retail revolution that has happened and will continue to win. So I think that's an important point to be made in all of this as well.
You know, so this just occurred to me, and I've used this kind of parallel before, but if you think about it, I think there's 8 billion people on the face of the earth. And imagine when 3D printing, becomes accessible and affordable for every person, we're going to have 8 billion supply chains.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Anyway. There's also another thing that's happening that's kind of interesting, Robin, and that's we call it the retail sub-economy. And it's all these different ways that consumers want to shop. For example, you know, and these models were 10, you know, $100 million models. They're now multi-billion dollar models. So this is like the consignment models that are out there.
Yep.
The thrift models that are out there. Two of my adult teenagers are bought all of their back to school through thrift this year.
Wow.
Etsy, which is craft. And now you see retailers trying to partner with some of these models, which is just absolutely fascinating. So the consumer is in full control, which is really fun to watch. As a retail operator, whether on the restaurant side or the retail side, it's a challenge because places where you have made profit are all under challenge right now.
Correct. And the variable costs of doing business are expanded dramatically. So, yeah, So the financial models are also changing.
Yes.
Okay, on to another subject here. So, yeah, many of the innovations of the Retail Radicals that we, you know, we launched that program last year, and many of their innovations really originated in or were facilitated by e-commerce and online capabilities. So anywhere, you know, from AI to personalization to direct-to-consumer, digital natives. So as hard as it is to imagine, we are seeing the maturation of e-commerce. So what does the retail landscape look like after the disruption as we head towards, I think, Don, you coined this to quote-unquote normalization. And Don, you want to kick that off?
Yeah, you bet. So we've been talking about maturation of e-commerce for some time, and I will tell you the most forward-thinking clients of ours, either on the retail side or on the brand side, all have a point of view at what point does the growth being driven by e-commerce start slowing down and maturing. And we're already seeing it in some subcategories in some industries. Other industries are kind of at the in their early stages of this. And there's a lot of factors to that, Robin. But the reality is that many of these retailers, it's very expensive for them to ship something to you versus you coming to drive and pick something up in their store where they have sunk costs of labor and rent and utilities, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're finding is the best, what the consumer is saying to us is we really like these models that have stores and e-commerce and blend the two together. And the best in class people that are doing that, of course, are Walmart, Target, Best Buy is doing a great job of that. On the apparel side, Nordstrom and Macy's do a great job of that. So it's going to be interesting to see, but that appears to be the winning retail model from the consumer's point of view.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, and you're right, there are going to be different levels of the percentage of online business versus physical business, depending on the industry. So it will be very interesting to see where that ends up. But even though e-commerce may be maturing a bit, the C-level guys I talk to still really don't have a handle on where that percentage is going to end up. And you know, if they did know that, they could build strategy around it. But so it's, you know, everybody, we're in the middle of it, and nobody really has an idea of where it's going to end up. But David, you want to talk about the food industry in this?
Absolutely. And as Don alluded to, and some industries are more mature than others. In the food industry, we're still in the developmental stages. When we look at the restaurant space, for example, we see about 6% of all restaurant orders right now are what we call digital. In other words, they were placed either on a smartphone app or on a website. But over the last 5 years, total customer visits to restaurants have averaged about a negative 0.2% rate per year. Over that same time period, those digital orders have increased by 23% per year on average. So this is clearly the one area of acceleration. And when you look at restaurant chains that are winning today, they're the ones that are driving traffic through that mobile app. And a lot of it, as Don described in the rest of retail, it's about pickup. We talked about earlier the problems with delivery from an economic standpoint, but the digitally ordered carryout or takeout business is booming. It's the fastest growing part of the restaurant space by far, and I think what you're going to see is this too is going to cause a reinvention of the brick and mortar restaurant landscape, because you cannot just take all this influx of digital orders and pour them into an existing box without creating some disruption. And this famously happened to Starbucks a couple of years ago that they talked about on their earnings report. Their digital app was so successful that it disrupted the normal flow of operations in store, and they blamed that on missing earnings on this one particular call.
Wow.
I think you've seen Chipotle CEO Brian Nickel has spoken publicly about this, about how they have reengineered certain stores to have a separate make line for those digital orders, a separate pickup spot in the restaurant for those digital orders, because the last thing you want is your loyal in-store customer, you know, waiting in that line, and some digital order guy comes in and cuts right in front of him and gets his food and walks out. That's not a good recipe for making your customers happy. So they've learned to compartmentalize those things within the same box, which requires, you know, a real re-engineering of your whole operations. Has implications for the back of the restaurant, the front of the house. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of rethinking of restaurant operations and how that goes forward. And I think we're seeing the same thing on the grocery store aisle. Look, the brick-and-mortar grocery store is never going to go away. Some people like to go to the grocery store. It's an enjoyable experience for them. But what happens within the four walls of those grocery stores is going to change dramatically. Why should I ever go shopping for toilet paper again? There should be an algorithm-driven auto-replenishment model where my toilet paper shows up, hopefully just in time, or maybe a little better than just in time. And if that's true, then how are we going to repurpose that space inside the grocery store? And so we're encouraging food and beverage manufacturers to rethink what is the purpose of that store, how can we engage consumers experientially, how can we teach them to solve for these problems that they're facing in home that demand the convenience, how do we show them how to get the best possible thing they can get out of their Instapot. You know, I think these are the kind of things that you're going to see happening in store more and more often on the retail side.
Listen, Amazon is already, delivering staples like a light bulb. I had a friend who went home one night, there's a package on his front porch from Amazon with a light bulb in it, which he had not ordered. So he's sitting in the living room, and an hour later, and a light goes out in the kitchen. So, you know, they are able over time, you're right, to track this cycle of, you know, toilet paper, paper towels. So you don't have to go to a store for that. So Matt, expand a little bit on this maturation topic in your.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Robin, that it went, 20 years ago when the e-commerce was still in its infancy, people thought nobody would buy shoes online because of the fit issues and so forth. And it turns out our data shows that about 30% of all shoes last year in the U.S. were sold online. It's one of the most penetrated businesses. And I think there's a couple of real interesting reasons why. First of all, the physical store today and always has been a problem are always out of sizes and colors. They never have a complete stock on everything. If you want a size and the store's out of it, the internet has that. If you see a shoe in green and you want it in blue, and the store doesn't have it, the internet has that. And I think that has driven a tremendous amount of business to e-commerce. The other really, really important story here is the direct-to-consumer side of the business. The athletic shoe brands in particular have really pushed very, very hard to grow their direct-to-consumer businesses, and it's a significant part of their overall results every quarter. This, of course, has driven more and more business to the internet as well. So we think that we will continue to see growth here, but the growth rate is definitely going to slow. The kind of meteoric growth that we saw is a thing of the past. But we still expect to see a further penetration in footwear. So I think it's a different kind of environment. And, you know, if someone asked a question earlier, it's like I think every industry is going to have its mature number. It's not going to be one number for all industries. I think it's going to be a number that is unique to every industry. And then one other sort of forward-looking thing is maybe in 10 years we're not even talking about this topic anymore because, as Don said, everything is blended.
Yeah.
So for instance, let's talk about BOPUS, Buy Online, Pick Up in Store. Is that an online purchase or a physical store purchase? Well, it's really both. And this is how the two things start to get wound up together. If I'm in a store and I order a product on their kiosk and have it sent to my house, is that an online purchase or an in-store purchase? So I think the lines are going to blur between the two, and maybe in 10 years we're not even talking about them as if they're two distinct things.
Well, you know, and the other phenomenon is that the space necessary in the physical world is shrinking. And, you know, you have Nordstrom out there testing this Nordstrom local where they don't have a stitch of merchandise. And you got the other traditional stores who are thinking about and understanding that, you know, they're going to have showroom kind of type physical stores where you might not have the full inventory there. So, I don't know, it's kind of like the service merchandise model. Which was before its time, Don?
Yep.
Yeah.
It really was. And I think what we're going to see, Robin, and one of the things that we try to help clients think about is it's really breaking down into three pillars. There's going to be companies that do the customer acquisition or demand generation. There's going to be companies that do the actual transaction, the retail transaction, and then there's going to be companies that do the fulfillment. And the companies that were in all three of those pillars 10 years ago and the companies that are going to be doing that going forward might be very different companies. And it's going to be really fascinating to watch. One thing that we're looking at pretty closely this holiday is every retailer in the world that has stores would love to be able to press the reset button and kind of start over and say, if I were to come to market today between my online assets and my store assets, and I were to start from scratch, what would I do?
Yep.
And we're actually going to see that this holiday with a brand that's been around for many years that dominates a category, and that's Toys R Us. Toys R Us, unfortunately, went out of business, filed bankruptcy, et cetera. And they are coming back this holiday with multiple models of consumer interaction, including experience, including another retailer hosting their website and fulfillment for them, including a demonstration model with Beta, who you've talked about before. So this is going to be really interesting to see a retailer come back that can press the reset button and engage with the consumer in today's world. And will the consumer engage with it? It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Yep. It's a whole new world emerging. So, you know, we got time for one more question. And this, of course, it's a very timely one as we're about to head into the holiday season, which actually some say it's already started. It starts earlier every year. Anyway, can you guys comment on how you think retail's position for this year? And if you can, who do you see will be the winners and losers, if you care to mention that? And if there's any major difference from prior years? And finally, what advice do you have for brands, retailers, and food service operators to optimize their business this year? Matt, you want to open up with that?
I'll be glad to. You know, I think with the short season this year, six fewer days, one fewer weekend, one less weekend than we had a year ago, it's going to force more business to the internet for convenience. I think those retailers who make the shopping experience as convenient and as frictionless as they can are going to succeed here. I think gift cards are going to be more important than ever because it's a simple purchase. You can make it online and be over and out in a couple of clicks. I think convenience is going to be a very, very important topic. I also expect this to be a very promotional holiday. I think the retailers are going to panic because of the short window, and we're going to see them putting many more products on sale earlier and more deeply discounted than we have had in the past.
So, David?
You know, food and beverage consumption behavior is not seasonal, unlike what my colleagues are tracking. You know, we eat every day. regardless of whether it's a holiday or not. What does change is that around the holidays, we actually, very traditionally spend a lot of time at home and prepare a lot of meals at home. We are still dramatically, large percentages of us are going to eat our holiday meals either at home or at someone else's home. What is changing is that we're increasingly gifting restaurant meals to other people in the form of gift cards around holiday season. So I would expect restaurant operators to want to try to take advantage of that this season, as they have been increasingly over the past few years.
Okay. Don, you want to wrap it up?
I'm happy to wrap it up. So Marshall Cohen, who's our chief retail advisor, he has publicly come out and said we're looking across all the businesses for retail to be somewhere between 2.7 and 3.2%, so about a half a point swing in between that prediction. And in the past, we've been pretty accurate on that. MasterCard's coming in at 3.1, and NRF, a little more conservative this year than they have been in the past, at 3.8 to 4.2% growth. So it's going to be a solid holiday. I think there are going to be winners and losers. I think that we're going to continue to see e-commerce growth. It's just so much convenience. Certain categories are going to pop. Certain other ones are going to continue to be challenged. It's going to be interesting to see if apparel comes back this year and gets back on the gifting list, Robin. That'll be interesting to see. With video games moving more and more online and being distributed electronically or digitally, that's going to be interesting to see what the impact of that is. Electronics will still be hot. It was an Apple holiday last year between the wireless headphones that they have, the iPad, and the Mac. So we'll see. I think it's going to be a solid holiday for the consumer this year, but the timing and the cadence is going to be very different.
Yeah, I would agree with Marshall's projection. Which isn't the 4, 5, 6% that we're hearing from some other people. Anyway,
right.
That is a wrap. And this was very fascinating for me. And I really do wish we could go on for at least another hour. I was honored to have all you guys. You're brilliant. And you are truly informed experts. And I must say, I learned a lot. And I'm sure our listeners did too. So
thank you
so
Robin.
Much, Don. Thank you, Don and Matt and David. And by the way, for our audience to learn more about Holiday 2019, visit npd.com, and they're going to have frequent updates on the season as we go forward. And you can also sign up for their blog on the site, so you will be able to stay in touch with Don, Matt, and David that way. So thanks again, guys.
Thank you for tuning in to the Robin Report podcast series. If you want to find out more behind today's program and what's next, be sure to check out therobinreport.com and sign up for our email list in order to be at the forefront of what's new in the retail and consumer product industry. Join Robin Lewis again for another edition soon.